This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Gaza today is a war zone. Fighters from Hamas and Fatah are in open combat after yet another ceasefire collapsed. The two Palestinian groups are supposed to be part of the same unity government that now may be near collapse itself. And the situation is further complicated as Hamas and Israel launch attacks against each other. There's been a series of Israeli airstrikes in Gaza today following rocket attacks into Israel. This is hardly what Palestinians hoped for when they voted Hamas into power last January. The Islamic group's electoral victory shocked outsiders, but many saw Hamas as the logical choice for people tired of corruption and eager for change. But those outsiders, Israel, the United States, and the European Union, refused to fund a government dominated by a group they regard as terrorists. As the crisis deepens, we'll talk today with a reporter who grew up in a Palestinian refugee camp in Lebanon, who's interviewed many of the key players, and who's now written a book called Inside Hamas, The Untold Story of the Militant Islamic Movement. Later in the hour, we'll talk with a former Army machine gunner who's the winner of the Blücher Prize. That's right, Blücher, best book to originate as a blog. But first, Inside Hamas. If you have questions about the current situation in Gaza or about the origins, funding, the ideology, the allies, and the goals of Hamas, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email talk@npr.org. And there's a conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Zaki Shahab is the London Bureau Chief of Al Hayat, and he's been a leading Middle East journalist for 25 years. He joins us here in Studio 3. It's good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, Neil.
It's been a bloody day in Gaza. Is the unity government going to survive this?
In fact, it is the bloodiest day Gaza ever have seen. I've just talked to one of my friends today, and he really told me the situation is extremely bad. And he was wondering, as I myself as well, how far a ceasefire called by Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh in Gaza and the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Many things really have happened the last couple of months of great importance. When Hamas and Fatah reached an agreement in Mecca, this agreement was of great importance. But unfortunately, none in the West have taken notice of such an agreement where a Hamas leader, Hamas prime minister, was sitting behind Mahmoud Abbas in the Arab summit and before that in Mecca. Where the Hamas government have given Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, a clear support to whatever negotiation or deals he can reach with Israel. Hamas, at the same time, have recognized all the agreements which have signed either by Mahmoud Abbas or before that by President Arafat with Israel, which is, I think, an important step where Hamas practically, in other way, said we would recognize the state of Israel without saying it. So this, ignoring this fact and then going into a unity government with Fatah have really upset or disturbed the extreme element within Hamas, who found after 2 months of forming this unity government that the West have not really fulfilled the promises that if they go at such length, they would ease the life of the Palestinian and make the ordinary Palestinian living in Gaza or West Bank feel the fruits of such a step. So this failure on the side of the West have left the Hamas extreme elements with many things to take against their moderate leadership. And at the end of the day, said, what's the point of we taking part in a unity government while, in fact, we have won the election with a large majority and in spite of the advices we have received by either Mahmoud Abbas or from other Arab governments that if we take such a step to form a unity government, the West might talk to the moderate elements within this unity government or even to Fatah members in this government. The fact that the difficult situations continued have alerted Hamas leadership to announce the cancellation of the ceasefire, which was already reached with Israel.
You said it was an important step for Hamas to back the Fatah president, Mahmoud Abbas. This has happened before in your own book. Here, in public, Hamas avoided any mention of the destruction of Israel. On paper, it began to look as if Hamas was not miles away from the PLO's agenda, which offered a two-state solution to achieve peace. In reality, though, Hamas Hamas's public concessions were just window dressing. And a couple of lines later, Hamas senior told me, "You will never find anyone in Hamas who will recognize Israel's right to exist. If you do, he's a liar."
The fact is, Hamas, at the end of the day, if the people in Gaza or West Bank decided to take a stand against whatever they will do, mm-hmm. Hamas would obey and try to respect the will of the people. But there was no hope for the Palestinian. There was no promise that an independent Palestinian state would see the light in a year or two or three. At some stage in 2003, the American president, George Bush, have announced that within 5 years there will be an independent Palestinian state. In 2004, he changed his mind. And he said, by the end of 2009, when he met Prime Minister Sharon, more than a year and a half or 2 years, he said, dates are not important. We need to give the Palestinian living in Gaza and West Bank some hope that if they respect the peace agreements, if they, you know, try to listen to the international community, this would bring them peace and a life where they can live in dignity. Mm-hmm. But the kind of promises, unfortunately, is not there, in spite of the efforts which has been made the last few months by the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice. We have seen nothing practically achieved by the visits she made to Jerusalem and Ramallah. According to one of my sources, I think the maximum she have achieved is she managed to convince the Israeli government to allow 5 trucks full of tomato to move from Gaza to West Bank. This is the biggest achievement. When you talk about the embargo on Hamas-led government, who are paying the price? The ones who are paying the price are the members who either working for the security or for the different institutions led by Mahmoud Abbas. Practically, they are the one who recognize the state of Israel. Practically, they are the one who have negotiated peace with Israel. While a Hamas organization, as an organization or its military wing, they never been part of the government. And by all means, they have never been affected by the embargo which was imposed on the Palestinian Authority, because the money kept running to Hamas. And since it won its election, Iran have opened all the doors and channels to make sure that Hamas would receive the money they need.
Mm-hmm. This raises a question, and getting back from the current situation to the meat of your book, which is the origins and the development of the Hamas organization. There is the role of Syria and Iran in this organization has been, it certainly didn't originate it, they weren't the origins of it, yet they have been critical in terms of supporting it.
Hamas, at the end of the day, is a Palestinian movement. And if you want to take it further, it's part of the International Organization of the Islamic Brotherhood.
Mm-hmm.
Countries like Syria and Iran have taken advantage of the boycott and the treatment Hamas received by the international community. When you corner someone, at the end of the day, he have to find somewhere to go and someone to support him. And because Hamas in the United States, for example, is listed as a terrorist organization, because of the stand taken by the European Union on this regard, as a result of pressure came from Washington, Hamas practically is blacklisted. And they left Hamas leadership with no other option but to stay in Damascus or have this strong relationship with Iran. But if you give the Palestinian people in general the hope, I'm sure Hamas would consider whatever reaction the people in Gaza and West Bank will take. And I can take you back a few years when Oslo agreement was signed.
Mm-hmm.
There was not a single suicide bomb attack against Israel, because Hamas leadership have understood the message that the people in Gaza would go against them. There were some hope that if you do such thing against Israel, you are spoiling our hopes and our, you know, dream of having a Palestinian state. But there is no hope today, and that's why the fighting is taking different shape, to the extent that some might go, there is no authority anymore. It's either militias or clans fighting each other.
Let's see if we can get some listeners involved in the conversation. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And our guest is Zaki Shehab. His book is Inside Hamas, The Untold Story of the Militant Islamic Movement. And let's begin with Steve. Steve with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I never heard this from the mainstream media or from NPR, but a local Portland alternative media outlet reported that Fatah receives significant financial support from America. I'd like to know, is this true? And if so, does that undermine the legitimacy of Hamas and undermine their ability to maintain order?
Do you mean Fatah as itself, or Fatah as part of the Palestinian Authority?
I'm not sure how you would distinguish it.
Well, as part of the Palestinian Authority, it certainly did get a lot of American money, didn't it?
I really don't have a strong memory to go back that long, but I can talk about the latest approval by the Congress of $19 million to the Palestinian Authority. The fact that this was approved by the Congress, Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, was not happy at all, because the $19 million approved, more than half the money would be spent on logistics, spent by either administration or travel or car. So what would reach the Palestinian, in fact, will not be more than $3 million, to the extent that Mahmoud Abbas was considering seriously telling the Congress, thank you, we don't need your money. Because at the end of the day, when a starving Palestinian living in a camp in Gaza or Rafah or Khan Yunis would hear such thing, that the American administration is supporting the Palestinian security forces, they will think, oh, he's like an American agent or working on behalf of Israel. And this would not really give Mahmoud Abbas any favors. The fact that Mahmoud Abbas was so angry to the extent that the cost of training a Palestinian security forces will not need more than $1 million or $2 million, to see $17 million just wasted between the approval from the Congress and handled by American officials or whoever would be responsible for delivering the money, this is really a big waste of money. And at the end of the day, all you hear, either here in the States or anywhere in the world, that the Congress have approved $19 million. But the fact what would reach the Palestinian is only a couple of million dollars. The Palestinian think they can do with less than that.
Steve, thanks very much for the call. We'll have more of your calls after we come back. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. With the fighting ongoing in Gaza today between Hamas and Fatah, we're talking with Zaki Shahab. He's political editor of the London-based Al Hayat, and his new book is called Inside Hamas, The Untold Story of the Militant Islamic Movement. You can read about his first visit into Israel and to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, among other sites, in an excerpt of his book, which is on our website at npr.org/talk. If you have questions about the current situation in Gaza or about the origins, the funding, the ideology, the allies, and the goals of Hamas, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also go to our blog at npr.org/blog of the nation. One of the things you do in your book is profile many of the important figures in the Hamas organization. And let's start with the most important one and the first one, Sheikh Yassin. Tell us about him and who was he? And you describe him as an extremely charismatic man. Even when he was in Israeli prison, the other prisoners would compete with each other to take care of him.
In fact, the first I managed to know about him was at very early stage, in the early 90s. Definitely after the break of the First Intifada, 1987, most of my conversation with him would be over the phone. Mm-hmm. Because I wasn't at that time a British citizen, but when I had my citizenship, it gave me the opportunity to visit Palestine for the first time. I grew up, as you know, in a Palestinian refugee camp in South Lebanon. And I traveled and worked in London in the early 80s. So most of my calls with Sheikh Yassin was over the phone, asking him questions about developments taking place. And so the first trip I made to Gaza, it was like, the first time I see him face to face. And I was like, felt surprised about this humble house he have, the way he receive people around him who coming like for help. The situation in Gaza, it's much worse than South Africa at some stage, and it's quite a crowded place. It's very difficult life. If the lucky ones who would have permission to go and work in Israel, believe me, it's not easy for someone who lives in a Rafah camp to go and work in Israel. He have to wake up like 1 o'clock in the morning, take the journey to Erez checkpoint, which will take him sometime 3-4 hours to get to the checkpoint, queue,
line up.
In this lineup, you know, and it will take, because of security checks and things, he would wait another an hour or two at least, then he would have to go into Israel. Mm-hmm. He would finish work 8 o'clock or 7, and then he have to make the journey back. By the time he gets back to his home in Rafah or Khan Yunis, it's nearly close to midnight. So practically, someone who is lucky or considered lucky by the eyes of other Palestinians who don't have the permission to go and work in Israel, he have to work at least 20, 22 hours leaving his house. So this kind of environment, I met Sheikh Yassin, and as you know, because of the secrecy and the willingness not to speak over the phone, so there's always like limit for how far they can explain things to you. But during the visits I made to Sheikh Yassin over the years, and at that time I recall that Ismail Haniyeh, the present prime minister of Hamas, was responsible for his office. So every single meeting I held with Sheikh Yassin, or most of them at least, Haniyeh was present. So that's my relationship with Haniyeh goes back to the early years where I met Ismail Yassin, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. So the kind of treatment, like, you know, for ladies, widows, whoever would come asking for help, he would like give his son or any of the people around him the hint, go and see what these ladies want, or if they want asking for money, or they have problem, he would intervene. Far from this, he always enjoyed this sense of humor in spite of the seriousness of the situation. For many, I was really surprised that Sheikh Yassin himself, he told me even till late 70s, he never been an active member of the Islamic Brotherhood. So his history didn't really go that back in the movement, in spite of his belief in Islam, and he'd been like in a scholar teaching religion all his years. He never been a member of this Islamic Brotherhood movement, and then a leader of that movement in Gaza. The early years of Hamas movement, as he told me, he have enjoyed, in a way, the facilities which given to his movement by the Israelis directly or indirectly. And at that time, Israel's intention is to weaken Fatah, who was leading the struggle against the state of Israel.
The central organization of the PLO. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And Sheikh Yassin himself, he told me that straight after the first visit by President Sadat to Jerusalem, he approached some of the pro-Sadat Palestinians in Gaza, and he asked him if he can help in getting a permission to set up the Islamic University, which became the center of for the leadership of Hamas. And the condition, as Sheikh Yassin related to me from this Sadat Sheikh in Gaza, that if you visit Cairo and express some kind of support to Sadat for his visit to Jerusalem, it would be easier to get the permission. And he used his tactics to say, I will consider this, but let's apply for the application. And the Sheikh managed to get the application to rebuild this center from the Israelis within a very short period. So Israel, directly or indirectly, have encouraged Hamas at least to extend in terms of social circles and try to offer Palestinians in general different kind of help in order to weaken Hamas. Far from this, the first cache of weapon which Hamas managed to accumulate was given to them by the Israeli intelligence Shabak. And when Sheikh Yassin was arrested by the Israelis along with other leaders of the movement, the Israelis know exactly who bought the weapon from them, so it was easy for them to take back the weapon and sentence the group for the first time.
Yeah, there's a long list you describe in your book of original members of Hamas, all of whom, one after the other, are died, most of them assassinated, including Sheikh Yassin and his successor, Mr. Rantisi. There's another character I just wish you would tell us a little about, Yahya Ayash, known as the engineer, a man who responded behind many of the suicide bombings.
Yahya Ayash, according to his comrades, his wife, the people who know him, was an extremely extraordinary man, to the extent that he would found it easy to move from his village in West Bank to go to any to Gaza anytime.
Master of disguise.
He is a master of disguise. He would like dress as a Jewish rabbi, and he will just have a large collection of Israeli IDs, and he would cross the checkpoints with no time.
Mm-hmm.
To the extent that, according to some of the people who worked with him, if he would get bored in Gaza and he would look for some peace and quiet, he will drive an Israeli plated car and have a break in Tel Aviv. And his Uzi gun is with him.
Dressed like a settler. Yeah.
He would dress like a settler, and he would, like, you know, do everything. Just, he can disappear.
Yeah, there was a point, I think you quote an Israeli official, might have been Yitzhak Rabin, saying, I'm worried that he might be here in the Knesset with us, the Israeli parliament.
Because they've done everything to trace him, and they have failed.
Mm. But he was the one who is credited with the idea and sent the first suicide bomber into Israel to attack targets. What motivated him to do that?
I think at that time, the attack against Al-Ibrahimi Mosque in Hebron was the
Baruch
attack.
Goldstein, the Brooklyn-born...
Exactly. This has really infuriated not only Palestinians in West Bank and Gaza, but I remember I was visiting Tehran when it took place, and I can see Muslims worldwide were so angry about such an incident taking place in one of the places which is really dear to Muslims worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
So this really was like the start of suicide bomb attacks against Israel. And Yahya at that time, he was like fully trained. He had the facilities. He had the skills. He had the imagination to start a campaign, which I think at that time when it happened, he promised that in revenge for such attack against the Al-Ibrahimi Mosque, he would carry 10 suicide bomb attacks against Israel.
And ironically, as you say, in the end, the master bomber killed by a bomb placed in a cell phone that
he
exploded.
He killed
next to his
by bomb because after many, many years of struggle by the different Israeli intelligence, they managed to penetrate some of the closest people or people who was related to one of Hamas members who was befriended, mm-hmm, or friend of Ayyash, and they used a mobile telephone to kill him.
Yes. In fact, one of the fascinating chapters in this very interesting book is, in fact, a story about a chapter about the informers who are used against Hamas and various other Palestinian groups by the Israelis. Let's get another caller on the line. Bob is with us. Bob from Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Hi.
Hi, Bob.
I hear a lot of pointing of the fingers at the West and at Israel and stuff, but what I'm wondering is, what I've seen develop is a culture of violence among the Palestinians where all the issues are really settled instead of by discussion, but by violence, as we see today in the outbreaks between Hamas and Fatah. And what I'm wondering is if you could comment a little bit about how that's become entrenched in the society as a way of dealing with disagreements and arguments.
Bob, it's not really a matter of, like, you know, pointing the finger at the West and held the West responsible. But when, you know, people worldwide, they know of a united nation, they know that there are international law, they know that there are so many crises in the world and wars and hot spots where the United States, the United Nations, other international forces have intervened. You know, when it comes to solve a crisis, you have to enforce things on both nations. Unfortunately, when it comes to the state of Israel, the United States, the United Nation would shy away from enforcing a solution which would be acceptable to both. I'm sure you would agree with me that when you want to make a peace, you don't make a peace with a friend, you make peace with enemies. And to reach peace, both parties have to make concessions. So there are so many agreements which has been signed here in Washington, in Cairo, in Oslo, who are very clear. And when,
sir, you still haven't answered my question.
Can you just repeat the question?
Well, he was asking to what extent is the is some of the problem due to a culture of violence?
I don't agree with this. As I mentioned earlier, there was, like, at some stage where not a single shot fired at Israel for nearly more than 2 years. But when people have no hope, Gaza is a small jail, not a large jail. And people have no chance to get out of that place. The only exits they have is only two exits. One is at Rafah.
I see lots of places around the world where there's no hope. but it doesn't strike me as those places. Whenever there's a breakdown,
I can assure you that I've been covering war zones all my life, and there is no worse place like Gaza at all. People, you know, have no chance; they have no opportunity to go anywhere, and the only crossing they have is the one with Egypt, Rafah, and it's closed an average of 4 days a week. Many people have been dying just because they don't really have opportunity to cross the border with Egypt for treatment. Mm. So it's really a very sad situation.
Bob, thanks for the call. We're speaking with Zaki Shahab. His book is Inside Hamas. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Mike on the line. Mike with us from San Rafael in California.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like Mr. Shahab to comment on some of the phrases in the Hamas charter, because I think that these really provide some of the basis for the barriers to achieving a peaceful settlement. Hamas says in its charter directly, Israel, by virtue of its being Jewish and of having a Jewish population, defies Israel and the Muslims. And it says, in order to face the usurpation of Palestine by the Jews, we have no escape from raising the banner of jihad. Hamas has stuck by this and has shown no signs whatsoever of compromising on this.
That's what you said is completely true. But on the other hand, there is also something in the Knesset which has just made it clear that the border of Israel is like within the two rivers, in reference to the Nile in Egypt and the Iraqi two rivers. So anyway, this is not the point. The point
wait a second. There has been no such statement whatsoever by the government of Israel.
It's in the Knesset.
Extending out to the two rivers. That is a falsehood that has been perpetrated over the years. That has never existed.
Well, let's talk about Hamas at this point. Its charter does say...
The point here...
And you say in your book that they're determined to go back to 1948.
Let's go straight to the point. The point is, I'm sure you would say, in other words, if Hamas would recognize the state of Israel. Let's be clear about it. And on this front, you know, it's fair to ask this question, but what would Israel give in response for such recognition? There are other Palestinians who have recognized the state of Israel, have agreed that Israel should live in a secure, within secure border, have the right to be part of the Middle East and part of the area. But what Israel have given these people? The fact is, in any marriage between a couple, you know, you have to agree on certain matters, that to say, yes, I want to marry you, if you are a female or a male, you know, it have to fulfill some conditions before. And I'm sure, you know, we have to give Hamas the chance. As I mentioned, there was Mecca agreement where Hamas have accepted all the agreements signed by the Palestinian Authority, by Mahmoud Abbas, by Arafat. What Israel have given in advance, the last meeting which took place between Prime Minister Olmert and Mahmoud Abbas, Olmert have asked Abbas why Hamas are not committed to the agreements. And jokingly, Mahmoud Abbas asked him, are you yourself committed to the agreements we have signed with you? So it's really a matter of the question. We need to build confidence. It's time that we should make it clear. If you ask the other party to make steps toward your recognition, you have also to make clear that the Palestinian, within a certain date, should get what they need as well.
Mike, thanks for the call. We just have a minute left with you. I did want to say at this point, you come to the conclusion at the book, and I think it's one that everybody will agree with. Whatever you think of Hamas, it is not going away. It's certainly having political difficulties at this time. What is going to emerge? Can Hamas, first of all, come to some living agreement with Fatah itself? Can we get a government in the Palestinian territories which then can speak with one voice?
Many important developments have took place recently in West Bank and Gaza. Not every single election in terms of unions, students, lawyers have been taken place in Gaza or West Bank and been won by Hamas. It's all won by Fatah.
Mm-hmm.
Because Hamas, after more than a year in power, the people around them, they found out that they are not capable of governing. And if we go ahead and give
Hamas and others who are in power the opportunity to survive. I'm sure a future election will not see a Hamas government in place. The reason Hamas have put aside the idea of a pure Hamas government have failed is a big, big success for the moderates in Palestine and the Arab world and even the outside world, because Hamas was forced to accept a unity government after they realized that they have failed.
Zaki Shahab, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate your time. He's the London Bureau Chief of Al Hayat. His new book, Inside Hamas, The Untold Story of the Militant Islamic Movement. When we come back, Colby Bazell, the winner of the Booker Prize, joins us. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.